Hello, John.
Hey, George.
How are you?
I'm frazzled. How are you?
Yeah, I'm a little frazzled. I drove back yesterday from Denver back to Santa Fe, which is about 400 and some miles.
Jesus. What?
I went up to a place called NREL. It's the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's the same place where the Coors Brewery is.
Yeah. I once was on a picket line outside of the Coors Brewery.
Yeah, I was thinking while I was up there that you had a Colorado connection for a while.
I was in Denver in the late 70s, and Coors was a real union-busting place. I don't know if it still is.
Right.
But back then, it had huge union troubles. And
yeah, I remember when we were asked to boycott Coors beer, which was not exactly a hardship.
Yeah. But what were you doing at the renewables lab?
Well, I'm working on a big article on solar energy.
Oh.
For National Geographic.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so that was kind of my first stop, and I decided, you know, it'd be fun to do a road trip, so I drove up on the interstate highway and then came back down the mountain route, you know, US 285.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Over the Front Range.
It's beautiful.
But we had the first snow of the winter, so it was really icy, and so I wasn't really bargaining for that, so that was a little nerve-wracking, but I made it.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good. Well, I guess the reason I'm frazzled is, well, first of all, Susie just 2 days ago flew to Tanzania to visit her friend India, who is building an orphanage for children there, and already has something like, I don't know, I think about 20 children staying with her, and so Susie is going to spend a month there, and you know, in a way that India does for these children what Susie tries to do for birds.
For the birds, yeah.
And this will be a real test of Susie's misanthropy, you know, because Susie thinks there are too many humans on the planet. And
Right, yeah. And now they're encouraging the growth of them.
Yeah, but she's already written an email to say that she safely arrived and she was just marveling at how beautiful it is and how when she and India arrived, all the children and the employees at this orphanage came running up as though she was Princess Diana, Susie said. And they were so joyful to see her.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, this should be good for her attitude.
Yeah. But this
doesn't mean that she's wrong. There are too many people on the planet, but you have to have empathy with those who are already here.
Yeah, and you know, Jeffrey Sachs dealt with this issue in his most recent book. He said that you know, he's talked about how we need to provide better health care for these really poor people in Africa, and he says that privately, rarely publicly, people come up to him and say, "Well, there are too many of them, aren't there? And if they don't die of malaria or dysentery, they're just going to die of starvation later on or in some war." And Sachs says, actually, no. What the data show is that when you take care of health care and reduce infant mortality, that it tends to be associated with greater social stability later on.
And probably more likely to be able to implement some kind of population control.
Birth rates actually drop.
There's some kind of it's kind of feedback mechanism, it seems like you know, if your population, whatever creature or animal or plant it is endangered, there seems to be some sort of internal mechanism that causes you to reproduce more to make up for it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have no scientific basis for that, but it sounds true.
Well, it's somebody, you know, it doesn't have to be some sort of deep, unconscious, primal urge. It can be just that some of these adults want to have more children who can take care of them when they're older, or take care of them if they get sick with AIDS.
Yeah, so it works on a cultural level.
Yeah, so they're perfectly rational.
Psychological
reasons.
Level. But I wonder sometimes if there's something deeper, and this is, I've noticed, you know, here in Santa Fe we have this huge problem with this invasive species, the Siberian elm tree.
Yeah.
And, you know, it came from Siberia, and it was planted early in the 20th century in New Mexico by Easterners coming here that wanted, you know, good old Eastern-type shade trees. And these things were picked because they grow really, really rapidly because they're adapted for Siberia.
Right.
You know, so you bring them to the Southwest and they really thrive. But one thing I've noticed is whenever we have a really, really dry dry spring, you know, like we're in the worst parts of the drought, these trees will put out vastly more seeds than they do when it's been a fairly wet year. It's almost like there's a mechanism that's saying, whoa, you know, we're really endangered as a species and now we need to proliferate. And it's horrible because every one of these things, like each tree will put out several million seeds, about 99% of which seem to be viable. And if you don't pull them up, you'll have nothing but a forest of Siberian elms in your yard.
You know, it's interesting because I think that can go the other way with mammals. So, for example, when female mammals, including humans, if they don't have enough body fat, they become infertile. I'm pretty sure the case. So women even start. You know, you've heard that female athletes sometimes stop menstruating when they become really lean. And I think this happens when you are starving as well. So there, it's sort of a natural form of birth control, instead, because obviously, you know, if they don't have enough resources to take care of themselves, they can't take care of offspring either.
Yeah, so but, you want to contract the population.
Right.
That's
anyway,
interesting.
I just
have to look into this.
So the reason I'm frazzled
beyond
is
the level of anecdote.
Right. But you know.
So you're frazzled because you've been abandoned, basically.
I'm a single parent
for an African
now.
Orphanage.
So this morning my kids are in different schools now. So Mac is in high school and Sky is in eighth grade and this other middle school. And so I had to ferry both of them to their separate schools, or actually help them catch the buses.
Do you have a minivan?
No, regular buses.
No.
Oh,
yeah,
you mean do we? Does my family?
Yeah, like a minivan. I was thinking.
No, we've got
something like Sarah Palin, the hockey dad.
They have a minivan. Well, they've got five kids. I guess they need one. We just have a Prius that takes care of. That takes care of our needs. But then I have a two-hour commute. Not to complain, but what the hell?
Two-hour commute,
just to let blogging heads people know the lengths we go to put on this wonderful show every week or a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I rushed back from Golden, Colorado.
Yeah, and I rushed here. I'm at Stevens now. I had a two-hour commute in here, and I'm reading some of this crap that we're supposedly going to talk about today. Of course, which we haven't gotten to yet. And then as soon as I got here, I had a meeting for the Green Committee at Stevens. We're trying to encourage all the students and faculty to take green issues seriously and revamp the curriculum and make the campus reduce the carbon imprint and all that stuff. And so then I rushed over from that place, which is right across the street from my building, and then I called you, and then, of course, you had this problem with
that stupid camera
that Blogging Head sent you.
Yeah, the zooming thing, it was starting to do what it did with our last show, where it would just suddenly maniacally start zooming in on me, so my nose would fill the entire screen.
Yeah.
You know, and I had talked to Brian, the tech guy, about this, and he said it's apparently something that's going around with this particular camera. And, you know, I assumed that he would have a fix, like I needed to download, you know, some flash ROM update or something like that. And he said the only thing that works is to super glue the zoom switch into the into the left-hand position. So, I don't know, I just kind of rebelled against taking this camera that must have cost hundreds of dollars when it came out and super gluing the zoom switch. You know, it might slip while I'm super gluing and be in the wrong position, and then the camera would be ruined. Didn't Plus, you, if I ever wanted to Zoom for any reason, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Didn't
so
you
I was
put
trying
tape?
To fix it. Well, I was headed out with screwdrivers, and I was taking apart different plates, and then finally I popped the top of the Zoom switch off, and then I pried out the spring with a screwdriver.
Yeah.
And now it seems to be behaving itself, so we'll see. No well, super glue yet.
Well, the question, it might be like one of those cases where you knock out a gene that you think has only one simple function in a, you know, a nematode
right.
worm, and it turns out to, you know, knock out not only its excretion function, but its ability to burrow forward or, you know, something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, there's all these cross-connected circuits.
I guess.
Like with old vacuum tube radios. It used to be that if you pulled one of the vacuum tubes out while it was running, it would start making this loud pitch squealing sound. And then you could conclude from that that the purpose of the vacuum, this particular vacuum tube, is a squeal suppressor.
<That's good. laughs>
But actually, of course, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But anyway, it seems to be working now, so fingers crossed.
Well, that's good. So,
We were going to talk about Jonathan Haidt, right?
Yeah, moral psychology and politics and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I watched that TED video that you recommended, and it was really interesting. I mean, I've heard and read his ideas before and read some of his stuff on edge.org, and I think we've talked about him sometime, but it seems really appropriate now with the campaign scene getting into its... You know, with the campaign winding up and getting nastier and nastier, and this why don't you summarize what?
Yeah,
Haidt
sure.
Said.
Well, so Haidt is somebody. I think it's fair to say he is doing work in evolutionary psychology, and particularly in the evolution of morality. And he says that there's a lot of evidence that. Our values, our moral tendencies are not completely learned. They're not instilled in us by culture, but are to some extent innate. And by the way,
and he refers to like a rough draft of like a moral structure that evolution bequeaths us.
Yeah, and he says, you know, he's got some of the boilerplate that you get from people in evolutionary psychology, like our good friend Bob Wright and Steve Pinker, and he says that one of the worst ideas that has ever been put forward is that we're born as blank slates, and everything that we are is inscribed on our minds by experience. He says
right,
that
the old John Locke and the British empiricists.
Yep. And he says that this is true not only... So one of the first really great examples of that was that language is innate. So this was Noam Chomsky's great thesis, which he advanced, I think, in the 1950s, was pretty much accepted over by the next couple of decades, although I guess it's still debated. But what Haidt and a lot of other people have talked about, Bob Wright, Pinker, Mark Hauser has written about this. He's a... biologists at Harvard, is that
right.
Moral values also are to some extent innate, that there's certain core moral tendencies that you see in all cultures. And, whether they're very sophisticated cultures in modern European countries or the United States or tribal societies. And he's got four values that he says he thinks are really universal.
Five. Yeah, I made notes.
Yeah, I had to too. tell me if I've got these right. So the first one was I wrote down harm and care. So I guess it's the idea that you instinctively feel compassion for others who are suffering.
Yeah, like if you walk, if somebody, you know, if you walk down the street and someone is, you know, beating some poor defenseless puppy or child, and then you'll probably intervene, and if you're too timid to intervene, you'll at least feel, you know, really bad about it and be shocked.
Yeah.
So that's number one, and number two is fairness/reciprocity.
Right. Which is sort of summarized in the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And third?
Tit for tat.
Right. Third is in-group loyalty. And so, you know, there are two aspects to this. You are, you know, you've got the back of people within your group, and you're very loyal to them, and they, in turn, are loyal to you. But you are, you don't show this loyalty to people outside your group, and you may even be hostile towards others outside your group.
Right.
And actually, Haight has a great line that when he was talking about in-group loyalty. He says that there are lots of different manifestations of tribalism. Some, of course, are lethal, and some are harmless and can be harnessed for entertainment purposes. So sports is an example of that. Right. And Haight says that sports is to war as pornography is to sex.
Right.
I'm not sure if that was his line, or it seems like something he probably quoted from someone else.
Yeah, I can't remember, but yeah, so, I mean, you can see how in-group loyalty, how evolutionary pressures would, you know, encourage that to become, you know, kind of a wired-in basic function, and yet even when it's not necessary, it's, you know, it's still there, so we divide into sports teams or gangs or...
And it is astonishing how easily that can be invoked in people. I mean, I keep trying not to be a sports fan because it's a total waste of energy. I know that rationally, but I can't help it. So I'm a diehard Mets fan, and it really causes me much more pain and aggravation than pleasure.
Yeah,
but I can't help
it. I'm really low on that number three, that in-group loyalty.
Well, see, I've
never had any interest whatsoever in sports.
Well, what about patriotism?
I don't know. I guess it bothers me a little, you know, if people say something stereotypically disrespectful about Americans or or New Mexicans or people named George. Or so I suppose a little bit. But one thing that really interested me about Haight's thesis is that these five things, he compared them to little slider switches like on an audio equalizer, and in different people they're all set at different levels.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and so for my, the number three is down pretty low.
Well, the thing is, I am sort of an anti-patriot. I think that patriotism is one of the most destructive values.
Nationalism
that,
in general.
That we have. So I am, you know, I do my best observe any patriotism welling up in me and try to stamp it out, because I think we're all sort of citizens of the human race. But as I said, I still get caught up in these stupid tribalisms, like, you know, Mets are great and Yankees. I Haight the Yankees, so that's the, you know, in-group out thing. And I actually think that
I just don't get that.
Yeah, it is. Well, you should. It's stupid. But
on the other hand, I don't think I would ever vote for a Republican, just in principle.
Yeah.
So I guess I do kind of, yeah.
What about Michael Bloomberg?
Well, I don't know. There you go. That's true. And I think I did vote for Giuliani when I lived in New York City.
And, you know, we've got to the Republican...
This is back when Giuliani seemed like a better guy.
Yeah, God, now he's repulsive.
Okay, well, yeah, let's get... That's three. And then four was authority / respect. So, like, this ingrained view that... that it's important to respect authority. And I think I'm a little higher. I'm higher on that, I think, which always kind of surprises me because it doesn't always fit my, you know, my mental image of myself. But
yeah, so this can be manifested in family relations, so respect toward your parents or your ancestors, as well as respect toward, you know, elected officials. I guess even people with fancy college degrees or journalists who write for places like the New York Times.
Yeah, respect for tradition.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, even though rationally, you know, there's no real reason for the tradition, but, you know, what the hell? You know, I mean, if it's not a harmless tradition, it might provide some kind of cohesiveness. So I can feel that down somewhere in my bones.
Yeah, maybe you have more of that than I do. I sort of, I almost have a knee-jerk
Oh, totally. I mean, I mean, so, you know, ever since you wrote The End of Science.
Yeah, I like tweaking.
Yeah, so
that.
your authority respect is like turned down close to zero, right?
I guess it is. I guess it is.
Okay, so then number five is purity / sanctity.
Yeah.
And this idea that there's virtue in controlling your body, your primal urges, what you put in your body. And this was something that struck me that Haight said that for conservatives, this is manifested by sex, the importance of controlling sex and being kind of disgusted by sex. And for liberals, it comes with food.
Yeah.
This idea that it's very important to have these pure organic foods and, just as irrational in many ways. I mean, there's some scientific basis for some of that, but not for a lot of it.
Yeah, I thought it was important that he pointed out that purity and sanctity, you could find manifestations of that both on the right and the left. But,
right. You
know, the major point he was making in this in this little lecture, and by the way, I highly recommend it to the Blogging Eds people. It was only about, I don't know, what, like eight minutes long?
Yeah, it's a nice short video.
And
yeah,
he's quite
the
showman.
We'll put a link to it. And I meant to say that this was a talk given at the TED conference, and the TED stands for Technology Entertainment Design.
Yeah.
And I think the name of the talk was something like The Real Difference Between Liberals and Conservatives. And to return to the equalizer metaphor, these five dials are turned into two generally different patterns depending on whether you're more liberal or conservative, right?
Yeah, so, as I said, the fifth one, purity and sanctity, said you can see this on both the right and the left, but he said in general, liberals are really high on harm and care. Mm-hmm. And fairness, reciprocity.
Number one and two, yeah.
Number one and two, and conservatives are much higher on in-group loyalty,
yeah.
Authority and respect,
right.
And purity and sanctity.
Yeah, so that kind of rings true, and it really struck a chord with me, because I remember having this conversation once with a friend, and we were talking about trying to understand, you know, the difference between Republicans and Democrats, or people who were pro-choice and anti-choice, and I should say pro-choice and pro-life, to use each group's own.
Oh, George,
own
you're
labels.
Such a tolerant liberal.
Yeah, but again, that's showing my number two scale being turned up. Yeah, and then she looked at me and she said, yeah, it's just like they have different brains.
Yeah.
Liberals and conservatives. And I thought, it's true. I mean, whenever you get into an argument with someone like that, it's like these two completely immiscible world views. You know, you just don't. You just butt off each other like oil and water. And
So
this kind of fine grains that in a neat way.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit, you know, a couple of things bother me about this. First of all, you know, here we are. We're good liberal Democrats. And I think this is sort of, this breakdown is flattering to us, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, and of course we know what side that Jonathan Haight is on.
And yeah. So I would like to hear a smart conservative, although, you know, is that an oxymoron? Anyway. A conservative intellectual.
You're too high on this. Yeah, no, you turn down your in-group loyalty dial.
Yeah, I know.
But
I'm.
Yeah,
I'm,
no, I mean, yeah, yeah.
So what they would say.
It was interesting, too, how he took the show of hands at the TED conference to see how many. He predicted there'd be very few conservatives, and sure enough. And his interpretation was because TED conferences were for these people that were interested in diversity and ideas and let a. You know, a thousand flowers bloom, and that this would tend to attract people with the liberal settings on the equalizer more than conservatives.
Yeah, and I don't know. So that part of it, that, you know, the idea that Haight is probably a secular liberal, and has come up with this breakdown of political values that favors secular liberals, That makes me, even though I'm a secular liberal, it makes me a little skeptical. Also, some of these things, you know, as I said, I thought it was really good that he pointed out that there's a left version of the purity, sanctity principle that you see.
Yeah, that made it seem a little less skewed.
Yeah, and also, you know, in terms of, so on the left, obviously, I remember one of the paradoxes of the 60s is that there was this, this tremendous pressure when I was a teenager to conform to nonconformity, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, to sort of show your rebellion by having your hair a certain length and liking certain kinds of music and literature and certain political values. And so it was kind of a knee-jerk, in-group reaction to another set of values, but still there was a tense.
Yeah, I often regret my, like, I think back in my college years and a lot of opportunities I wasted because of this knee-jerk, you know, need to be different and rebellious and eccentric. And
yeah. Well, that's probably innate as
kind
well.
Kind of the self-conscious, so that's kind of interesting.
And also, you know, obviously a lot of there are, on the right, there's nonconformism. So especially if the left is in power, then the people on the right tend to be the rebels. So, you know, I'm suspicious also of these. I would put this in the category of pop psychology. And, you know, it's just, it's a little bit too reductive, and you start examining it. It's sort of fun to think about, but when you examine it more closely, I think you should be very skeptical.
Well, yeah, but in general, though, it kind of seems to ring true to me that, I mean, of course, you can argue over, you know, what the scales are, what dials there should be on the equalizer, and the different patterns of the settings, but in general, it really rang true to me that there are these, it's almost like these two basically fundamentally different tribes. It's really struck me on this drive. I live in Santa Fe, which is kind of a, you know, Obama bubble,
right?
And as soon as I left Santa Fe and got on the highway heading toward Las Vegas, New Mexico, and I started seeing, I saw a McCain Palin sign, and I was kind of startled. And I realized it was, you know, I hadn't seen a McCain Palin sign, I don't think. And, you know, I mean, I must have seen one in Santa Fe. And then, of course, I started seeing more and more and more of them. And then especially when I was driving back down through the Front Range and across the... There's this valley that's kind of between the Front Range and the Sawatch Mountain Range, and down through little towns like Fairplay, and Buena Vista, which they pronounce Buena Vista, which really rankles me. But and then looking at all the, you know, and then seeing all the McCain Palin signs, and then I turn, you know, and I had my radio on, and I was just basically hitting the seek switch and going from talk radio station to talk radio station, hearing all the local advertising, and really, it really made me a lot less optimistic that Obama's going to win next month.
Yeah, I've been listening to ABC Radio, which is 77 WABC things. In New York, and it's it's pretty much all right-wing talk radio. It's where Sean Hannity is. Imus is Imus is kind of a soft right winger, but he's definitely in McCain's camp. Yeah. So they have Imus in the morning on, and a guy named Bob Grant, who's this really, you know, I find loathsome right-wing figure, Rush Limbaugh. And I've been listening to them lately to try to knock myself out of my, my sort of stereotypical leftist liberal thinking. And
did it work?
No, it's just...
Instead the team thing comes in, right? The in-group loyalty.
It's just they seem like just nasty... manipulative. Either they're morons in case of some of the people who are calling in, or they're these manipulative bastards like Limbaugh.
And then, of course, these people are doing it professionally. A lot of it's just, they're putting on a show to make money.
Yeah.
But then you hear the people who call in, and this is what really, struck me. I mean, it's nothing that I didn't know, but, for example, there's different ads, too, that are being put on these radios to appeal to different people, and they're not the ads we hear so much on mainstream TV. Like, there was this one, and they had... It was some famous country western singer. I forgot who it was, Merle Haggard or someone like that.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about, it was a pro McCain commercial, and he was talking about Obama. His famous comment at that, I guess it was a San Francisco rally or meeting or something, where he was talking about lower middle class Americans in the Midwest clinging to their, feeling threatened and endangered, and therefore clinging to their God, their guns, and their religion.
Yeah.
However he put it, and of course, this, what struck me is a very astute analysis.
Right.
And
but
I'm
it
sure,
cannot be
you know,
said. It cannot be said.
You're just not allowed to say anything that is analytical in which you're expressing an idea. So of course, then the Democrats had to spin it the other way. But the Republicans are still seizing on this. So Merle Haggard was quoting Obama or whoever this country western singer was as saying this, and then just stirring this resentment. Saying how he just doesn't get the importance that we have for our God and for our guns that our grandfathers gave us. And just pulling out all the stops and just dealing, just hitting people in their reptilian brains. And it just made me realize what's depressed me so much about this whole campaign, both from the Democrats and from the Republicans. We've just, and it's, gotten this way every election for the last 20 years, I guess, but there's just no more of this sense of, actually discussing ideas.
Well, I think
on their merits. It's all just playing to the reptilian brain, and the debates, I think, have just been horrible.
I don't think they've been horrible, because I think Obama has kicked McCain's ass, and
I'm really disappointed in Obama, but let me give you an example.
Okay.
There's like in the second debate, McCain brought up this ridiculous thing about Obama putting one of these evil earmarks in a bill to get money for I can't remember how many million dollars for a projector.
Right.
For the Chicago Observatory.
Yeah.
And Obama just kind of, he didn't respond to that. He just kind of smiles and goes on to something else. I mean, to me, that's a perfect example of where he could have really seized the moment and redefined the debate and said, he should have been armed with the information, and he at least should have been armed with it when McCain incredibly brought it up again in the next debate. But
yeah.
Obama could have said, this is a projector in the Chicago Planetarium, and the Chicago Planetarium is one of the great cultural institutions, not just of my state in the Midwest, but of the country. It's showing kids who come in there, and these are kids also from the south side of Chicago, and showing them the beauty of the universe, getting them interested in science. And to me, I think that's exactly the kind of thing that we should be getting federal money for.
Oh, wow, that was eloquent, George. But
your idea is, no, that's not strategically good, because I'm ahead a few points in the polls, so
that's
therefore
the problem.
I'm just supposed to dig in, and we're not supposed to discuss ideas. Or, just whenever you get this anti-tax Yahoo populism from McCain and Palin, the response should be, John, whenever I think of taxes, I remember a quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, the justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, the taxes are the price we pay for living in a civilized society. And it is patriotic to pay taxes.
Jesus,
my running
George,
mate, Joe
should,
Biden, was correct.
You should
but,
be.
You know, the whole...
You should be a political consultant. You are so eloquent. I feel like voting
but these
for
are
you.
All, these are all ideas. I mean, the whole liberal tradition, from Franklin Delano Roosevelt has just been completely abandoned, in embarrassment by the Democratic Party, and they're still trying as hard as they can to squeak in under the radar by seeming as Republican and Yahoo right-wing as they possibly can. Like Hillary Clinton, talking about slugging down Boilermakers and then going out hunting. It's just pathetic.
Hey, listen, I want to ask you about something.
I'm sorry, I'm getting off.
No, that's I'll be glad when this is over and Obama wins too. But I just wanted to ask you about something. I have misgivings about it too. A point that Haidt made at the end of his lecture, and you could sort of see this coming, but I just wonder what you think of it. So he said, of course, you've got these innate tendencies and this great divide between people we call liberals and conservatives in this country, and it's led to this great division, blue states, red states, and so forth, and a lot of hostility across that divide now. And so he's sort of saying at the end, why can't we all get along? And he's telling these people, primarily liberal, in the TED conference, who like to think of themselves as very open-minded, enlightened, and so forth, and seeking progressive change, he's telling them, you have to understand and empathize more with people on the conservative side, because
their realities is as real to them as ours is to us.
And he said that we need those values. So basically, the conservative values can be summed up as placing order and stability ahead of maybe fairness, universal fairness, and compassion for the poor, and so forth. And that you can't really have one without the other. And what bothers me is that this is just another liberal value. I actually mentioned this last week when I was talking with David Barabee.
Oh, yeah, that was really good.
Well, David has talked a lot about some of these.
Yeah, the us versus them, which this is just kind of a, it seems like a, feeds right into that.
But
the two different brains.
What I said, I sort of blurted out at the end without really explaining it, that why is it the liberals who have to be tolerant? So the problem is...
I heard you say that. It's because we're we're higher on the number one and the number two scale. So, we're all for diversity, even if it's against ideas we find reprehensible. Like the ACLU going to bat to, defend the right of Nazis to march in some parade, whatever that famous incident was.
But at some point, we have to draw the line, don't we?
I think one thing that Haidt's paradigm maybe misses, or maybe it's just because he's not interested in this particular question, is how these two sides vie within each one of us.
Yeah.
Because I definitely have moments when I, kind of lapse into a more right-wing kind of mode. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes liberals will just drive, like certain liberal pieties drive me crazy, and I just like going to Whole Foods and right next to the aisle with all the expensive Cabernet Sauvignons, and then on over here there's the really super expensive $20 a pound steaks, and then you have the aisle with the macrobiotic medicines and all this complete pseudoscience and
homeopathy. Yeah,
it just makes me cringe. Are these people, this whole idea of how it's supposed to be really great to buy your cereal out of some bin and scoop it into a bag because it reminds them of their pathetic little college co-ops.
Oh, George, you're such a crank.
So that's my conservative, great, tradition, and you have to have respect for General Mills and all these companies that.
Well, that's your
stuff in boxes.
That's your respect for scientific authority too, which is part of your persona as a science writer. And one of the points that David Barabee made is that he said that he originally decided to write his book because he was tired of some of these dualistic ways of dividing people, sort of free market capitalists versus communists or red state, blue state people. And he said that, we all have multiple identities and that our responses to different situations are much more complex than most of these models account for. But the thing about tolerance that bothers me is if you're just trying to think about sort of a political system that will really work over the long haul, there's an asymmetry in the way that tolerance works. So let's say I am tolerant in such a way that I allow a fundamentalist group, an evangelical fundamentalist group, to thrive, even though they are not tolerant back toward me. They think that their value system is absolute, and so they will try to impose their values on me. Now, if they are content to have their own little commune or whatever and practice their absolute value system within that and not bother me, that's fine. But some of these non-tolerant ideologies are very aggressive and are going out and trying to convert other people.
It's a paradox. I mean, in the great marketplace of ideas, you're supposed to encourage people whose goal is to shut down the marketplace of ideas,
right,
and impose some kind of totalitarian. Yeah.
So there's this weird self-undermining quality to tolerance. It's actually similar to skepticism. So skepticism and tolerance are both sort of meta values that are sort of weirdly self-contradicting or self-undermining.
Because I mean they're based on this assumption that there's many different ways of viewing and understanding reality, and yet, you know, you have to believe that the way the general, you know, liberality or liberalness in its most basic definition of just, you know, believing in, you know, the flourishing of lots of different competing ideas, I mean, if you believe that that's just one of the competing ideas, you know, that might be right or might be wrong, then the whole thing falls apart. So,
right. Well, yeah.
So we all have our different meta levels.
Yeah.
I mean, the two different groups have a different meta beliefs, and we don't compromise our meta beliefs, but we're willing to let beliefs on this next lower level flourish.
I mean, I just think that as a liberal progressive, there are certain values that you believe are absolute. So, slavery was wrong. We all agree on that now.
Wait, what was wrong?
Slavery.
Oh, slavery.
Are certain, you know, there's certainly quasi-slavery around the world nowadays, but, you know, pretty much everybody around the world says that slavery is wrong.
Right.
Women's rights.
And some things, you know, in astrology is not true.
Right.
Creationism is not an equally good way to, equally valid way to explain the development of life on Earth. But the Bible is not the inerrant word of God.
Right.
Yeah, so, someone wrote a book about this recently, but it's an old idea, but I just read a review. You know, this notion that secular humanism is just another religion.
Oh, well, is it John Gray?
It has its own core set of values, so everything that we're talking about, including Haight's five level scale of morality, this is all embedded within this more general view of, you know, secular humanistic worldview, where there are competing ideas and that you have this secular background. So we kind of think of the secular background as being this neutral canvas,
right?
You know, in which we paint our ideas, while to someone who's a religious believer of, you know, whatever stripe, they see secular humanism as being like a competing religion, or at least a competing philosophy.
This sounds like John Gray, a British philosopher whom David Barbee and I discussed a little bit last week. So he's got these two recent books, Black Mass and Straw Dogs, that both portray secular humanism as, just as you said, just ideology.
That's where I got that in my head. It was from watching your dialogue with David Barbee. And it reminded me of, you know, the very first book that I wrote was called Architects of Fear.
Yes.
Conspiracy Theories and Paranoia in American Politics. I kind of got into that, you know, those issues way back then, when I probably wasn't an accomplished enough writer to do them complete justice. And it started with, you know, like during the early in American history, the Jeffersonians versus the Hamiltonians, and the Hamiltonians would accuse the Jeffersonians of being in the grip of this evil French Enlightenment ideas, and you know, France was kind of to the United States then what the Soviet Union would become later, the evil empire of secular ideas and anti-religion, and you know, so again, you had those two different kinds of brains, and you could probably fit the Jeffersonians and the Hamiltonians in different fittings on Jonathan Haidt's scale. But it also manifests itself in conspiracy theories. So like the Hamiltonians thought the Jeffersonians were not only embracing these liberal philosophies and, you know, Locke and Hume and even worse, Rousseau, but they also thought that this was part of a conspiracy that was hatched by the Freemasons and the Illuminati to basically take over the new fledgling American Republic, and that the Freemasonic lodges were being used as hotbeds to discuss these dangerous French ideas. And, you know, and it's basically what we now would call secular humanism, but secular humanism won, so the conspiracy succeeded.
Well, I think the problem that Gray has with the Enlightenment and secular humanism isn't so much the ideas in themselves, but how they were manifested in the real world. And so with the French Revolution, you know, that led to the terror. So
yeah,
these ideas to be implemented required slaughtering those who disagreed or who were part of the old regime.
Or didn't require it, but yeah, that's what happened.
I mean, that just became, you know, once these ideas become part of a power struggle, then they can become lethal. And so in that sense, Gray is saying there was a lot of similarity between secular humanism,
crusade.
And, you know, it's supposed to be more rational, but it still leads to these cataclysms. I mean, you know, what happened to the Soviet Union, what happened with the Nazis. They thought that they were a very enlightened state originally, and, you know, scientifically organized.
So is he basically, you know, just talking about, you know, it's a complete relativism where we're not supposed to believe that, you know, despite these abuses, that secular humanism in its basic tenets aren't, you know, actually right and true.
I don't think he's saying
to be viewed. I mean, yeah, you can see why this would drive a fundamentalist Christian or Muslim crazy, because we're saying that our basic philosophy of, you know, secularism you know, that this is the background in which, you know, we have to explain and understand, you know, your curious, you know, religion.
Right.
And your strange little thoughts. This all has to be done within this framework that we're establishing. And they're saying, no, we need to turn this inside out. And the framework is that God created the universe and, you know, gave his only begotten son, et cetera, et cetera. And that we have to understand your weird beliefs within that context is basically sin.
I don't think Gray is not a real relativist. He's just talking about how ideas play out in the world. And he's just saying it's just an empirical fact that that the Enlightenment has not led to the fading away of religion. That we still have all these apocalyptic religions, and there's an apocalyptic sort of messianic utopian quality to secular humanism as well. And you can see that in Iraq, although, you know, the U.S. invasion of Iraq was complicated by the Christianity of George Bush, and, you know, so to say it's sort of secular humanism and free market capitalism imposing itself on another society, that's not necessarily gets a little complicated. But he's just saying
true. It's much more, it muddies it up.
So he's just saying the, you know, it's sort of the human impulse toward social self-improvement constantly leads to catastrophe. And that's fine. Yeah, we can see that in history, but I think that still there are genuine positive trends in human history, such as the eradication of slavery, the gradual advance in human rights. I mean, the fact that if you just look at this country over the last a century ago, women still didn't have the right to vote. I mean, I don't see how you can say that isn't a tremendous advance in human social organization. And I maybe it can go backwards, but I really doubt that it will. I think it's more that we're sort of one step forward, two steps back, three steps forward, and I just think that there is the secular approach, the focus on human rights, it will be self-evidently superior to others and will wipe out.
Yeah, well, this is kind of Francis Fukuyama's argument, right, in the end of history, that it's just natural that, you know, the world will eventually, and he thought it was happening a lot sooner than it did, I think.
Yes.
That we'd move towards this idea of liberal democracies, and again, using liberal, you know, in the way he's using it, John McCain and Sarah Palin are, you know, pretty liberal.
Yeah, liberal
democracies.
I mean, just
this basic idea of, you know, secularism, marketplace of ideas that, as opposed to some kind of religious received wisdom. And
right. But then,
you think that's probably that. Yeah, I guess sometimes I'm optimistic about that, but then you see this, you know, these huge backlashes. And
there has been a rollback in democracy around the world just over the past 3 or 4 years, apparently, which is a little depressing, but still there's been an increase in the number of democracies around the world. And, of course, it depends on how you define them.
And what you count as a democracy.
From about 20 after World War II to about 100 today. So I see that as another good sign. But I tell you, if John McCain gets elected, that will be a big setback for the progress of the human race.
Yeah, do you think? Wow.
Yeah, I do.
I don't know. I don't think it would be that bad, but
I know. Well, I'm exaggerating.
In so many ways, he's just playing on these, these primal fears and this, people's inherent need for authority, in the sense that someone's going to come take control, and playing on this revulsion that religious people feel for this, being viewed as, these quaint, these kind of quaint throwbacks by liberals and secular humanists. So he's kind of playing on that, very cynically to, get these people to vote for him. But, I doubt that he would, it's not going to be like Bush by any means. But
well, I just think that, our relations with the rest of the world could really use a boost, and McCain's election would not serve that well.
Well, I hope that's what Obama is doing also, is he's playing to the reptilian brain and his campaign mostly, and just not really talking about ideas and things that he really believes, and then when he gets in he'll be more like FDR. But I don't know. I was listening to while I was just in the last part of my trip back home yesterday, I was coming down the down through Taos Canyon and listening to some public radio show I'd never heard before. It wasn't one of the main public radio networks, but they were interviewing a real honest to God socialist. He described himself as an aging socialist, and I forget his name. He'd written some books and essays, and he was just saying how much it made him cringe when he heard Palin or McCain refer to Barack Obama as a dangerous liberal. And he said, on from his point of view, on a liberal to conservative scale, he was a lot closer to Richard Nixon than he was to, say, FDR, and to certainly to anyone who was a socialist. And how there was nothing. One thing they were asking them, people were saying that, this is socialism, having the government put all these hundreds of billions of dollars into bailing out the banks and these things. And he was saying, no, it's not socialism, which is too bad. If it were socialism, we would be, getting voting shares and not just, I guess now we're getting like preferred stock in some of these companies. But we actually would be controlling them, and the government would use its control of these companies to set policies, like say, look, you do have to give more loans to people in, these circumstances who, need help buying houses, or you're not going to give loans and finance bonds or underwrite these projects by these corporations that are sending jobs overseas, that you'll basically have an agenda and say, look, ha-ha, now we're in control and we have leverage over your company, and we're going to use it to have, impose social control and goals that are good for society as a whole, and it's not going to be so good for your profits, but obviously, you know, we have to make sure you get a decent profit and can still live well so we can keep, you know, improving society. That would be socialism, and that's not going to happen.
I just saw another Blogging Heads regular, I think his name is David Korn.
Oh, yeah.
He's a liberal counterpart to Pinkerton. And he was
yeah,
on MS-
yeah, they're great, yeah.
And he was on MSNBC last night, and he pointed out that Sarah Palin has overseen by far the most socialist government of any state in the union. There is a massive redistribution of wealth program at play that she has encouraged and amplified under her regime, taking the profits of the oil companies and distributing them to all the citizens of Alaska.
Right.
I mean,
that's been in place long before she was governor.
But she is. I think got taken an even bigger cut of the profits from the oil companies than was in place before. So the idea that, you know, this is socialism, and it's something that she's been practicing very aggressively on her own. So the idea that, you know, for her to be accusing Barack Obama of socialism because he wants to have a slightly more progressive tax than what's in place now is just, oh my God, it makes me feel as you do about how idiotic this whole election is.
And again, the response from the Democrats should be, redistributing wealth is a good thing. It's the whole basis of our progressive income tax.
Yeah, and you know, Medicaid,
which comes from FDR. That we're not saying that, you know, it's not like in Dr. Zhivago where he comes home to the family estate and finds the Communist Party has taken it over and says, you know, there were living spaces for four or five different families here in your house, and, you know, they've installed the families.
Right.
You know, they can say this is not what redistributing wealth is. It's just saying that if you're really doing well in society and making a lot of money, you know, you recognize that it's to your benefit to distribute some of this, if nothing else, is a cynical way to control the poor. You know, it's to your interest not for there not to be an uprising, a revolution. And if it's not going to be a revolution, at least it's, you know, to your advantage that you have less crime and robbery and murders because people on the lower level, you know, can be sure of having a certain minimal standard of life. So, of course, redistributing the wealth is a good thing, but instead, you know, they just react to it on kind of terms that are being set by the Republicans.
They
define the framework.
They stick to the talking points.
Yeah, it's just depressing.
Hey,
we've gotten way off.
I wanted to bring up one other thing before we break today. We've been meaning to talk about this for a while, but I thought this is something we should talk about before the election. And the original news peg was Bob Woodward's latest book, which was called, what the hell was his book called? It's basically about how everything...
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Oh, The War Within, The Secret White House History, 2006-2008. And in it, one of the newsworthy components of the book was that the Pentagon has some kind of secret program that enabled them to target and kill leaders of the insurgency in Iraq with great efficiency, and that this, as much as the whole surge, was responsible for the suppression of violence over the last year.
When I read about this, his book hadn't come out yet, and it was just one of his famous teasers that he put out and then refused to elaborate. And
well, he
so
still refuses.
Would buy his book. But does he get into any detail in the book, or is it
no,
still...
it was, you know, it's very hush-hush. He makes it sound...
He has to protect his sources.
Yeah, he basically says it's highly classified, and then he's been on some talk shows and you know, makes it sound as though, oh, man, I'd love to tell you because it's mind-boggling. It's this really amazing thing. But
By his next book, he'll be able to break the story. But I guess the image that what you kind of infer from this is maybe it's like could even be like satellite tracking, and everyone has a certain signature, whether it's just the way they walk, or maybe not satellite tracking, but you could imagine that you could use airplanes or satellites and just get this data stream, and it would include everyone has a different gait, a way of walking, different patterns of movements, and
heartbeat.
If you zoomed in closer, different odors and mix of molecules that they're spewing out into the air, and that somehow you could use this with complex pattern matching algorithms to track someone wherever they go.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of speculation about what it could be. So thermal signatures possibly, and it wouldn't have
thermal
to be satellites. Signatures. It could be drones. But I remember I did a story for Scientific American about 20 years ago on remote microwave sensing, basically using radar to detect human heartbeats through walls. So this was something that could be used for
different heartbeats. A combination of what your heartbeat is and your thermal signature, and the way you walk, and maybe your brain waves, the patterns of your electroencephalographic waves from your. I mean, this could all together be processed by some kind of algorithm, and then this would be you.
And then you send in, I don't know, maybe some little model airplane with explosives on it to blow up the guy, but the technology
or hit them with a tiny little niobium bullet from an umbrella tip.
Right. But actually, another clever idea that somebody came up with here was that you just put a transponder, a little chip in munitions, and you could just leave these explosives lying around Baghdad. And then the bad guys would pick them up, and they would think, "Oh, this is great. We can use this in a roadside bomb." And then you could track it and see that somebody had found it, and maybe wait for them to go to some place that is where the terrorists gather, and then you can blow it up. So the transponder is also hooked to some kind of fuse device. Which is
so you don't get innocent bystanders. I mean, it could just be like a mouse, electronic mouse trap. It would identify the signature and then.
Yeah.
But maybe instead of blowing them up, it could send some kind of little tiny dart with some poison on it. But then
somebody in.
That's really sick.
Wait,
I have an idea. This could be used. This huge problem that the Republicans are so worried about with Acorn. Supposedly registering all these voters who, are illegitimate. They're just making this huge, huge thing out of what's probably nothing. But this is how you could, we could have our voting machines identify you by these very various signatures when you come into the polls.
That's a good idea. I'm telling you, George, I think you have a future as a political consultant.
I'm sure.
Well, I just wanted to mention. One other suggestion. This was in the Star. And I pulled this off some website. The Toronto Star, speculating about what this Woodward secret weapon was. And this woman, Linda Hurst, suggested that it could be a voice of God device that makes someone think they're listening to the Almighty. This is an idea that's been around for a while. I think one of the inspirations is this guy, Michael Persinger, a Canadian scientist who invented the God Machine, which stimulates...
Oh, right. Yeah, we've talked about that.
Yeah.
You actually...
doesn't work.
You wore the God helmet, right?
Yeah, I wore the God helmet, and it doesn't work.
You didn't hear a thing.
But it's conceivable, and this idea has gotten a lot of circulation in the whole conspiracy, sort of high-tech conspiracy theory movement out there, and it's sort of made its rounds through the internet, and I was just wondering, if the Republicans got a hold of this, and of course they have it, if the Pentagon does, think of what this might mean for elections. What if they use the voice of God device to tell us to vote for John McCain and all the other Republicans in the upcoming election?
So this could be behind these recent change in polling numbers where McCain's edging up a little bit.
I don't know. Maybe it could even be behind some of these problems that you have with Barack Obama, George. You might be being exposed to the voice of God machine as we speak.
Yeah.
Or not.
Well, how do we know the candidates aren't being manipulated this way?
Well, that's a problem,
Manchurian too. Manchurian candidates.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Obama himself.
Well, you know,
and
maybe...
people are going to think we're just absolutely crazy. You know, so this is kind of... I mean, we're kidding, right?
Oh, you mean we're in danger of losing our credibility, George?
Well, yeah,
oh, no.
Well, you know, the stakes are pretty low here, so... Okay, I'm not going to worry about it, but it's, you know, it's fun to work yourself up into paranoid frenzies sometimes.
I love that, the voice of God device.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically, it would make you feel compelled to do things because you're getting the authority from on high.
Yeah, it sends a beam of electromagnetic radiation at your brain and tickles your, you know, God module and your politics module in such a way that you know, you think God has ordered you to vote for Sarah Palin and John McCain.
Well, if this is what Woodward's talking about and they have it, you know, in Pakistan, it's not really working.
No.
It doesn't seem like.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing.
I bet it's the tracking thing.
Yeah, it might be that.
That sounds more plausible.
And some people said it. Actually, Woodward, he's such a... I can't stand him. Someday in history it will be described to people's amazement. He compares it to the top secret Manhattan Project. But he says it's even more astonishing than that. And he says, the enemy has a heads up now because they've been getting wiped out and a lot of them have been killed. It's not news to them. It's a wonderful example of American ingenuity solving a problem in war. But then he can't say what it is. And then he says, the reason he can't say it is because people will be killed if he reveals what it is. But of course, the whole point of it is to kill people. But I guess he means the wrong people.
Yeah.
It's very confusing.
Yeah. Well, you think that as an editor at the Washington Post, he'd feel some sort of journalistic obligation to pursue this, but maybe not. I mean, if he's really comparing it to the Manhattan Project, where you know there was a certain amount of conspiring with the press to put a lid on the story until they were safe to release it.
One of the greatest delusions of all is that a technological advantage can solve some of these huge political problems out there.
Yeah. I hope he's right and they can, wind this thing up.
Yeah. All right, man.
Wow, that was a real, that was all over the place, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and...
I really needed to get some of this stuff out.
Yeah, I think we both did. It's a good thing this election.
So you're heading off on some interesting trip that I'm sure we'll talk about when you get back.
Yeah, the Singularity Summit. I'm going to actually debate Ray Kurzweil there. So that should be fun. Yeah, I'll talk about it. He's the guy who says we're all going to turn into computers or robots or...
Yeah,
whatever.
Just what we've been talking about.
Just another...
in a different context.
Yeah.
So are you going to be speaking at this or just are writing about it?
No, I'm actually, at the very end, I'm part of I thought it was going to be a panel, but now apparently it's just going to be a dialogue between me and Ray Kurzweil.
Oh, wow.
So it should be fun.
Wow. So, we'll talk about that when you get back.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
It's good, John, so hang in there, and I hope you survive Susie's absence.
Oh, I'll be all right. And
that's a great thing she's doing.
Yeah, and try to feel better about Obama, okay?
I will. I mean, I'm certainly going to vote for him.
Oh,
but,
good.
I guess we're not supposed to say who we're voting for since we're journalists, but...
Fuck that.
What the hell? Yeah, we're we're science writers.
Yeah, we're not real journalists.
We're all certainly not political journalists. So.
No.
Okay.
All right.
Good to talk to you, John.
Bye, man.